the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
It's always a good morning when you wake up to realize it's Friday. And if you're still trying to get into your summer bod like I am, USDA's Choose My Plate has a few tips to get you in the right direction. The website, which helps encourage Americans to build a healthy eating style, is also reminding people to focus on a few things: variety, amount, and nutrition when they look at the food on their plate. And if you're looking to make a change, start with small changes. In today's show, we will hear another round of our Waterworks segment in which Brian German talks about assistance offered by the Department of Water Resources. Also hear how innovation is creating an economic wave of opportunities for people in rural communities. And AgNet West, Taylor Hillman talks with the California Farm Bureau Federation about why one of the major changes to the Senate Farm Bill is addressing labor concerns and why that's such a huge deal for California farmers. And that's where we'll start today's news.
The Senate Farm Bill could be decided on next week, and one major change in their version is a big deal for the California Farm Bureau. Senate Ag Leader Pat Roberts hopes their version of the Farm Bill will be voted on the Senate floor next week. CFBF's Federal Policy Director Josh Rolfe says the bill has specific language for mechanization research, something CFBF says is a must for producers.
Yeah, in a bigger way, and in a bigger way than was in the House bill. The House bill has language that reiterates that mechanization is important and is something that should be targeted as a research need when universities are applying for these grant funds. What the Senate does in going further is not only do they have that language that prioritizes mechanization in a few different grant programs, but it also carves out some funding so that those funds will be dedicated to mechanization. And mechanization, for anyone listening, you know, it addresses our labor crisis. We've got to have a short-term look at addressing the current crisis, but we also have to have long-term, and that means looking at perishable crops that currently rely on that human touch for harvest, and mechanization offers that answer in the long-term.
There's a really simple test that can help save some frustration with irrigation systems down the line. Director of Cal Poly's Irrigation Teaching and Research Center, Stuart Stiles, told avocado growers recently that a simple jar test when applying products through their irrigation lines can save them from some hassle down the road.
Yeah, the jar test is a kind of an old school way to check what you're putting into your irrigation water from the fertilizers that you might be applying, or the acids, or anything else that you might be putting in as a chemical into the irrigation water. Sometimes just the product by itself might react with something that's naturally occurring in the irrigation water, and it can cause something to precipitate out. You'd get something solid, and those precipitates are going to cause plugging issues. The second thing is if you have two fertilizers or an acid in a fertilizer, sometimes they won't react well with each other and cause a precipitate to drop out. And then that's what you want to try to avoid too. And the jar test, it's a real simple test. You put together a concentrations that you want to apply, in a regular operation. You put those concentrations together in a jar and let it sit for 24 hours. And the next day, if it's a solid, you've succeeded in not plugging up your system. If it doesn't create a precipitate, then you can safely apply at those concentrations.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
And now here's Brian German.
The California Department of Water Resources continues to provide support for implementing groundwater sustainability plans. Deputy Director for Special Initiatives at DWR, Taryn Ravazzini, discussed the means in which the department can provide financial assistance.
So through Proposition 1, there was $100 million available for groundwater sustainability plan development. We went through two rounds. An initial round awarded in 2016 was for counties with stressed basins. So this was able to kind of focus on those critically overdrafted drafted areas and provide some initial assistance. But the last award was $85.8 million to 78 different applicants for projects within severely disadvantaged communities to help develop groundwater sustainability plans. The department continues to find other ways to offer financial assistance, whether it's within our own general fund budget or future propositions.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Residents in rural communities across America are able to build their businesses and prosperity, creating economic waves throughout their town with USDA's Rural Development Innovation Center. Rod Bain has the story.
Part of the collaborative efforts to improve rural prosperity and opportunities created by such includes fostering innovation. USDA is doing its part, in part, through what is known as the Rural Development Innovation Center, designed to identify and develop new tools rural communities can use to achieve improved prosperity and to create innovations that can be easily duplicated and shared among stakeholders. Among those in the private sector encouraged by the progress made by the recently developed Innovation Center is Chris Schaffner of CoBank.
They've been taking pretty incredible strides in the last several weeks and months to try to figure out how they can create the synergies and the consistencies in their programs that would invite the private sector to participate in a more meaningful way.
Schaffner is among those who believe this form of streamlining is essential for all public and private partners to better deliver strategies, tools, and resources to benefit rural America and spur its prosperity.
That was Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
After a recent outbreak of virulent Newcastle disease that began in May in Southern California, both the CDFA and the USDA are continuing their efforts to eradicate the disease. While the disease is not a food safety issue and hasn't been found in commercial poultry in the U.S. since 2003, there's still a concern about the potential for the disease to spread and cause significant losses in the industry. The eradication effort includes extensive outreach to bird owners and feed stores with tips for spotting signs of the disease. Public service announcements have also been produced in English and Spanish, providing important information about the disease.
This disease does not affect humans, but it can kill birds in just a matter of days. Don't move your birds. If you have birds that appear to be ill, please call the State Bird Hotline at 1-866-922-2473.
Biosecurity tips for commercial and non-commercial poultry owners can also be found on the CDFA website. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, National Cattlemen's Beef Association Executive Director of Government Affairs, Allison Rivera, discusses the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry's markup and 20-1 approval of the 2018 Farm Bill this week and what it means for America's cattle and beef producers.
So when we took a look at this bill, we were pleased to see permanent authorization of a vaccine bank with priority given to foot and mouth disease. We were a little bit disappointed not to see any funding attached to it, but happy to see permanent authorization that shows the support for the bank, as well as a little bit of increased funding for EQIP and some flexibility on haying and grazing on CRP lands during times of emergencies like we're seeing with the wildfires and the drought across the country. So there are a few items in there that NCBA has been pushing for, and we were pleased to see those in the package.
Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell did say the Senate will consider the Farm Bill before the July 4th recess, and Rivera looks at what action may be coming up in the U.S. House.
The hope is that the House will bring up the bill again next week. They've been in conversations to get the bill on the floor next week and hopefully get it passed. At the end of the day, we need the House to move forward. The Senate is moving. We want to continue to see that momentum. We want to get to conference committee so we can work out some of the kinks. There's obviously a lot of differences between the two bills, one being bipartisan, the other not as much. And so there's obviously some work to do. NCBA is ready to get the work going, and we got to do it before that September 30th deadline.
Again, that was NCBA's Allison Rivera. Well, and that Senate Farm Bill does include language establishing a vaccine bank to deal with an outbreak of foot and mouth disease, which is a priority for livestock groups. The House version of the bill also included FMD language as well. National Pork Producers Council President Jim Heimerl called the language encouraging, adding that with a vaccine bank, we'll finally be able to adequately prepare for an FMD outbreak. But he said we do need mandatory funding to make it work. NPPC says that currently the U.S. does not have enough access to FMD vaccine to handle more than a small localized outbreak. Studies show that an FMD outbreak here in the U.S. would cost beef and pork industries a combined $128 billion over 10 years. And Mexico is turning to the European Union and Latin America to offset any potential declines in U.S. pork imports. Mexico recently announced a 20% tariff on U.S. pork shoulders and legs starting next month in response to the steel and aluminum tariffs placed on Mexico by the Trump administration. Mexican officials told Politico the nation will allow 350,000 tons of pork from all countries to ensure that its consumers do not face shortages. Experts predict the quota will be quickly filled by the European Union and Latin America. U.S. pork will still be able to compete under the quota, but it is expected to see a sharp loss in sales from the Mexican tariffs. The U.S. sent 25% of its total pork exports to Mexico last year. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, they're working on that new farm bill, but nobody's betting it'll be done on time. I guess you could say October 1st because the current one runs out on September 30th. The House Ag Committee is working on the bill. Parts of it are ready for the full House. So far, some farmers like what they've seen, some don't. That's not unusual. Funding for a vaccine to control foot and mouth disease pleases everybody. Most corn farmers appear to like what they've seen so far. A few think it doesn't go far enough. Soybean farmers simply want a bill passed before the current one runs out. They're very likely to be disappointed. On the negative side, the National Young Farmers Coalition doesn't think the bill produces as much as it should for them. The progress continues. Well, we still have till October 1st. We'll see. That's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, Southeast AgNet.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
As we enter summer, some of us may not realize that soon around the corner, it will be harvest season. Actually, sooner than you may think, as winter wheat harvest is already underway in some locales. However, for a custom harvester like Raina Zeller, who provides manpower and equipment to forage growers across the country.
I know with us, we start sometimes the end of March, beginning of April, and we end up usually about the beginning of November, so it is a long 6 months. When we're working full time, we get about 14 to 15 hours in a day. When we're traveling down the road, we use all of our daylight we can.
But in addition to the long hours and heavy labor involved in ag work in general, and custom harvesting specifically, there is also the mental and emotional fatigue to consider.
A lot of times you're rained out and we sat in the same place for a month and they just get bored. They get tired. They get sick of sitting and doing nothing. A lot of times it's a hurry up and wait game. You hurry up and get there and then you got to wait on it.
So for such a long season, support to custom harvesters, and on many levels, is essential. Zeller says her company does what it can to be there for their custom harvesters, especially during downtime.
We just do what we can to try to keep them happy and ensure that we do a lot of paid time off hours for them. If we need to, trying to get them go places and getting them out of the campers is a huge thing. Taking them out to eat and just keeping communication with them, making sure they're okay, making sure they can get in contact with their families if they need to go home, trying to provide for transportation to get there or whatever it is. You have to really maintain communication with them and see where they're at mentally and emotionally.
Zeller adds the employers of custom harvesters, the landowners and producers, also play a significant part in support in the time they work to harvest that year's crop.
We have a lot of customers that are repeat customers, and they're very helpful communication-wise, just keeping us coming and checking in on us and saying, hey, it's rained out, how you doing, and things like that.
And she says perhaps the greatest support system a team of custom harvesters can have during their multi-month stretch of work is each other.
If you got a good team, they keep the morale up. Sometimes when you're sitting in the rain, you got a guy that owns a PlayStation or something, they share the PlayStation, or they all go out to eat together, or somebody wants to drive and go somewhere and take a pretty long trip. I mean, they work together pretty well.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Why you don't have to wait 5 months to celebrate a famous holiday meal. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. This may surprise you, but June is National Turkey Lovers Month. You might think this would be designated for the month of November, since millions of turkeys are consumed on Thanksgiving Day. However, two-thirds of the turkeys produced annually is actually consumed during months other than November. Turkey can be served in a variety of ways for each meal of the day. It's high in protein, which is important for building lean muscle mass and staying active. In fact, a 3-ounce serving of boneless, skinless turkey breast contains 26 grams of protein, only 1 gram of fat, and 0 grams of saturated fat. National Turkey Lovers Day is actually celebrated on the third Sunday of June, which is this Sunday. Whether you grill it, smoke it, or bake it, use the hashtags National Turkey Lovers Month and National Turkey Lovers Day to post on social media. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So I've been getting a lot of requests, and I mean a lot of requests, for fresh tortillas. So I'm going to give you a very simple recipe that I think is going to answer all of your tortilla prayers that you've been asking me to answer for you. This is my recipe for corn tortillas. Let's get started. So the first thing I'm going to do is, now if you're going to use, you know, your own dry corn, you most definitely can. Some people like to use the maseca, and I don't like to use the maseca only because it has a very just commercial taste. And I want to have something that tastes real authentic, and you can really taste the freshness out of that. So what I do is I take equal parts. So we're going to go with a half a cup of cornmeal, and we're going to go with a half a cup of AP flour, 2 pinches of salt. I'm going to add water to this as well. And with my water, I'm going to start with half a cup of water. And what we're trying to do is we're just trying to get all of this to knead together. The best way to do this is to put on a glove and to just do this with your fingers. I like to get my fingers and almost put them like, have them pointing out, almost like a fork. And we're going to just work the masa with our hands. Now, you can't really overwork this masa at all. It's almost impossible to overwork the masa for corn tortillas. But the number one problem that we have with making these is they're too dry. So if it feels spongy and it feels like it's you're able to mold it, because that's what we're going to do next. We're going to put it into a tortilla press. Now, the best way to make our tortilla press is I like to use just a nice, you can use a Ziploc bag or you can use a parchment paper. You always want to make sure that parchment paper has some fat on it. So I like to use some pan spray and go ahead and do that. Not too much, because we don't want the tortillas to take on that extra flavor. You put it over a hot comal, which is just like a hot pan. No oil whatsoever, because the natural oil that we have inside of from molding this will be more than enough to heat this up. If we were making flour tortillas, then yeah, that's a different story. But with the corn tortillas, we just want to make sure they're moist enough to form. And once we form them, we want to cook them for about 30 seconds on each side on a nice low medium heat. And if you feel like it's still a little bit raw, you can cook it a little bit longer, because everybody's stove is different. But I promise, this is one recipe you're going to love. For this and many more of my Untamed recipes, you can check me out at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leal. Last week, Brian German was in Kern County looking at potato variety trials. And on Wednesday, we heard Brian talk with Farm Advisor for Kern County Cooperative, Joe Nunez, about why the field day was important to growers. And actually, today we'll listen to an interview about how variety trials in Kern County are really the spearhead of the potato growing industry in the United States.
My name is Joe Nunez. I'm the Vegetable Farm Advisor Emeritus in Kern County for the University of California.
And we're here at the Kern County Potato Variety Trial Field Day. just before we get any further, what is the field day all about? What's being accomplished here?
Well, the potato field day in Kern County has a long history. It's been going on for generations, essentially. And what it is it's an opportunity for the growers to see all the new varieties that are being developed throughout the country and see how they perform here in Kern County, because our growing conditions here are a little bit different than where most of the potato varieties are being developed. There is no public or private breeding program in California whatsoever. So we rely on other breeding programs, either private or public programs that are going out there. And again, most of them are going to be in Canada, Europe, you know, Washington, Idaho, so forth. And we're here in Kern County in the desert southwest, so our condition is a little bit different. So we need to try these different varieties and see how they perform under our growing conditions here. So that's essentially what we're doing here, is we collect the varieties from throughout North America and Europe. They come here, and we plant them here, and then the growers get a chance to see how they perform here. Also, it's important to the potato breeders, whether they're from Canada, the U.S., or Europe, because we're the first ones in the entire country, or North America, essentially, that has a potato variety trial being harvested and displayed. So right now, the potato breeders are looking at their varieties for the first time to see how they performed under a commercial growing situation. So they're all interested in what's going on here.
And I understand this is a collaboration of different entities, and it's going on in multiple different places.
Yes, well, especially the Southwest Regional Trial. That's it's a program between California, Colorado State University, and Texas A&M. So Texas A&M and Colorado State are breeding varieties that perform better in the southwest part of the U.S., including Kern County. So we have a particular interest under those programs. So we work closely with the breeder at Colorado State and the breeder in Texas A&M, and because they seem to fit better for our growing conditions here. But we work with all the different breeders out here.
What were some of the new varieties that you were looking at this year?
Well, we have some nice ones every year, especially in observational. Those are materials that we just collect and we look at them. And some look really good and some of them are really poor. They just do not work under our growing conditions. So Centina, we found that several years ago. It's being grown pretty commonly now. It went through our program and most of the growers are growing some. And there's some other yellow flesh potatoes. There's a lot of interest in the yellow flesh potatoes nowadays. Not many growers here are growing any kind of russets whatsoever, because you know the guys up in Idaho and Wisconsin, Washington, they flood the market with russet Burbanks. So we don't even try to compete with those, because those are coming out of storage. So we're all fresh market here. So there's a lot of interest in the reds and the yellow flesh potatoes especially.
That's what was going to be my next question, is what the most interest is in. It's going to depend on really the type, is that right?
Yeah, the types. You know, you have the russets, you have the whites, you have the reds, and then you have the specialty types. And those are going to be mostly the yellow flesh. And that's where the interest is right now, is the yellow flesh. The consumer has really taken on the yellow flesh potatoes, so there's a lot of interest in that. And there's another interest a lot in the small B-sized potatoes, these little new potatoes. They're called new potatoes, but they're just a small tuber. So, you know, there's some out there that didn't yield that well, but there's a whole bunch of little small ones there, and those are actually would fit in with what a lot of the growers are doing here. Again, it's just another specialty market that our guys are going into.
And just for my last question, out of what you saw in the trials this year, were there any surprises or kind of interesting results that might not have been expected?
No, this is pretty typical as we got. Again, I've been doing this for 30 years now, and this is pretty typical what we got. Our yields are a little bit low this year as compared to some previous years, but every year is different. We see some difference in yield and difference in quality, but this is pretty normal. But the yield is a little bit less, but other than that, it's pretty typical.
Any idea what caused a shift in yield or just growing conditions in general?
Well, that's mostly our fault. We had to harvest a little bit earlier. I mean, I would rather have waited another 2 weeks before we harvested, but we were scheduled to have a field day today, so we had to go in when we had to. So I think if we waited another 2 weeks, we would have seen a little bit higher yield.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Excitement remains around drone applications in agriculture, and although there should be excitement, some experts are tempering those expectations too. Scholar Farms' Greg Krutzinger helps train people on how to utilize technology like drones. He told strawberry growers recently that they should be excited about drone potential, but they also need to realize that remarkable benefits just aren't there yet for every crop.
Yeah, so I think with drone data, there is, you know, what drones have done is democratized aerial data. And so, but right now we have quick and dirty data that's really cheap for color imagery, that's really easy to collect. And then we have more expensive data layers for, you know, multispectral data or plant health or whatever. So my excitement is, hey, this is getting easier. Right now it's super easy to spot check and look for variability in the field. What's harder right now is how do you interpret the data for really good interpretation of management decisions. And we're just not there yet for every crop, but every time of year, every, you know, management application. And that's where the work is to be done.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
After several months of watching grocery store food prices inch up this year, finally a little break.
We paid 0.4% less for our groceries overall in May than we did in April.
Agriculture Department food price analyst Anne Marie Kuntz, this week's Consumer Price Index showing steady or declining prices for all the food categories except fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, and bakery and cereal products. That's just during May, but overall grocery prices have still gone up since the first of the year, and
prices are actually up 0.4% so far this year. So that would be looking at the change in price from January to May.
And Kuntz is forecasting that after historic declines in food prices in 2016 and 17, 2018, we may see average grocery store food prices increase perhaps 0.5% up to maybe 1.5%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington. U.S. rice producers brought in a 20% smaller crop last spring and have been getting prices averaging about $2 more than the year before. But USDA Outlook Board Chairman Seth Meyer told us that has had a bit of a backfire effect. U.S. rice producers have been having
some struggles in terms of long grain exports in particular, just not very price competitive in the world.
Total U.S. rice exports for this current marketing year could be 94 million hundredweight, 19% less than last year. Now, going into this next season,
we think we'll get some exports back, both long and medium short grain in 18-19, so we expect there to be a rebound in exports year over year.
Meyer projecting about a 9.5% rebound in exports, but that's likely to come from a 14% bigger crop.
So price is coming down a little bit to a $12.40 midpoint.
Compared to $12.50 for this current season, that's the all rice price.
That was Gary Crawford reporting for the United States Department of Agriculture. And now for a recap of today's top stories.
The California Department of Water Resources continues to provide support for implementing groundwater sustainability plans. Deputy Director for Special Initiatives at DWR, Taryn Ravazzini, discussed the means in which the department can provide financial assistance.
So through Proposition 1, there was $100 million available for groundwater sustainability plan development. We went through two rounds. An initial round awarded in 2016 was for counties with stressed basins. So this was able to kind of focus on those critically overdrafted areas and provide some initial assistance. But the last award was $85.8 million to 78 different applicants for projects within severely disadvantaged communities to help develop groundwater sustainability plans. The department continues to find other ways to offer financial assistance, whether it's within our own general fund budget or future propositions.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Senate Farm Bill could be decided on next week, and one major change in their version is a big deal for the California Farm Bureau. Senate Ag Leader Pat Roberts hopes their version of the Farm Bill will be voted on the Senate floor next week. CFBF's Federal Policy Director Josh Rolfe says the bill has specific language for mechanization research, something CFBF says is a must for producers.
Yeah, in a bigger way, and in a bigger way than was in the House bill. The House bill has language that reiterates that mechanization is important and is something that should be targeted as a research need when universities are applying for these grant funds. What the Senate does in going further is not only do they have that language that prioritizes mechanization in a certain, in a few different grant programs, but it also carves out some funding so that those funds will be dedicated to mechanization. And mechanization, for anyone listening, you know, that's, it addresses our labor crisis. We've got to have a short-term look at addressing the current crisis, but we also have to have long-term, and that means looking at perishable crops that currently rely on that human touch for harvest, and mechanization offers that answer in the long term.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.